You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Death Tripping, with story and photos by Jeff Charlotte. I drove to the woods, in which Slender Man received his sacrifice. The girl lived, but the trees had been replaced by playing fields, which were filled with children, so I moved along, ashamed for looking. But shame didn't stop me from walking the Christmas parade route. It was similarly devoid of any sign of the nightmare just recently passed. I stopped for a drink, and the bartender told me that four of the victims, the members of the Dancing Grannies, a delightful group that was just as it sounds, had been killed out front. But you'd never know it now. Predicting violence the night Dobbs came down, Fox News pundit Monica Crowley described pro-choice America as a death cult. The left calls the right a death cult, too. But for all its guns and Punisher skulls and actual killers, fascism is actually worse than a death cult. It's an innocence cult, the belief that one might be as innocent of history, read race, as a fetus is of the world, perfect and pink, white, unbloody in the Dobbsian imagination of the womb. The gun, too, is made clean by the cult of innocence, born again, not as a tool of aggression, but of defense, as the protection of purity, inscribed by a growing number of manufacturers with stars and stripes and biblical verses. Advertised as a form of evangelism, a means of spreading God's goodness in the world, like a baby. The fetus and the gun. Small marvel nobody's yet put them together on a flag. More poetry is said to come from Wisconsin than from any other state in the Union. This from Black River Falls Badger State Banner, April 10, 1885. So what do you think? Do you think maybe Jesus' teachings is coming true right before our eyes? Also from Black River Falls Banner Journal, June 22, 2022. Black River Falls, Wisconsin. The protest began with one woman, and she's pictured here with a sign that says "F off" in large red letters. Standing alone on the Main Street Bridge over the Black River, down a gentle slope from the Catholic Church, holding a sign. Some cars honked, others revved. Black River Falls is a small town, 3,500, and Maddie Dean, whose father is a county judge, recognized many of the drivers. She knew who honked, because they believed, like her, that her body was her own, and who revved because they saw her there on the bridge, right out in the open with a sign that declared "Your misogyny is showing," and thought her profane. She watched a man she knew, the town extremist, with whose eldest daughter she'd been figure skating friends since first grade, drive back and forth in his truck, filming her with his phone over the steering wheel. Then he got out, big-bellied and bearded, looming over Maddie, who at 18 stands 4'11". He told her she was going to hell. "See you there," she replied. He insulted her mother. "Get the F out of here," she said. "I'm done with your ugly ass." Her friend Paige joined her, and then Theta and Lily drove by and stopped and made signs, and Paige went to gather others. A cheerleader for the Black River Falls Tigers named Peyton arrived with her F-off sign. It means if you don't believe in women's rights, You can just literally go F off. You ain't getting no pussy. You ain't getting nothing. It means, she said, rage. The town extremist returned with his wife and two of his younger children. They also took up positions on the bridge, waving giant placards of aborted fetuses. That's what some people do now. They're dead baby pictures. Faster now. The golden sky turned violet, then blue, so the teens declared victory, with plans to return to the bridge the next day, and decided to retire to Perkins. One of their mothers, Katie Del Cerro, invited me to join them for late-night waffles. The conversation was talk one might hear at such a table in any American town. College plans, summer jobs, social drama, crushes. There were multiple past and present student government officers at the table. It would look to anyone passing by like a group that might have convened with only minor fashion adjustments in 2012, the Obama years, or for that matter in 1982, the age of Reagan. But it's 2022, and these kids have lived through pandemic and insurrection and the slow boil of climate disaster. We remain mired in the Trumpocene, arguably deeper post-Roe than at any time in these young people's lives. So after an enthusiastic exchange about opossums, Katie, the mom, had rescued a wounded one and shared cute pics of the creature cuddling with a pet skunk. And local elk, there was a herd I could witness, they promised, if I drove slow in the night on the dark roads past the casino. The conversation turned to civil war, or as Theta, the oldest, put it, revolution. Theta had a year of college behind her. She was tall and sure, honey-skinned and gorgeous, because they were all gorgeous. There is innate loveliness in young people, celebrating the fight for their rights over late-night dinner plates, heaped high with calories for the struggle. There was also Carson, deep-voiced and funny, a mixed martial arts fighter, a woman who took no shit, and Paige, who is Ho-Chunk, and whose father moved the family there from Arizona to take a job for the Ho-Chunk Nation, and skinny blonde Reese, the youngest, who had just recently won a court case against another teen who'd assaulted him in a homophobic hate crime, and Lily, second youngest, a keen student of political currents, and Peyton, the cheerleader with the F-off sign. Sitting across from me was Theta's mother, Katie. Community mom, she said, crackling with pride for all, her daughter and her daughter's brave friends. Personally, said Theta, I am for some kind of revolution. I think people should be prepared to arm themselves, because it's been shown to women that we can't trust our government to protect us. Not at all, said Carson. Sometimes I take a Malcolm X approach to it, said Theta. I heart Malcolm X, agreed Carson. Like, said Theta, if they're showing violence to us, or not caring about violence that's happening to us, why not reciprocate that? My take, said Carson, who was Navy-bound, is I plan on using the government to my full advantage. And if we do get into a civil war, I will be transmitting information from the inside. It's something you worry about, I ask. Civil war? I'm waiting for it, said cheerleader Peyton, fiercest among them. And then I'm gonna... I thought of Death Trip, the book that had brought me there. Michael had been a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin when he made it, working on an underground paper. Cartooning, collaging, revolutionary art. Some took it further. There was a group called the New Year's Gang. They stole a plane and dropped bombs on an ammunition plant. They set fire to a ROTC center. On August 24, 1970, they drove a stolen van packed with 2,000 pounds of explosives to the campus's Army Mathematics Research Center and detonated. It wasn't supposed to hurt anybody, but it did. Killed a young physicist, father of three. Michael watched it all happen, and then he'd return to the paper's office. The student newspaper, he remembered, was under federal investigation by then because they'd published the killer's communiques, where he began making Death Trip, which means whatever you want it to mean, he told me. Katie, Theta's mother, clarified that to her, arming meant knowledge. Peyton clarified that to her, it meant guns. Her family has them, and she's known how to shoot since she was a girl. That's what I'm here for, said Carson. My dad is a Republican. Many of their parents were, and we have a lot of guns. I'll defend everyone else. I do a lot of hunting. Theta mimed, aiming a gun. I don't share that feeling, said her mother. But she knew her daughter was of age. She believed she must make her own choices about what's to come. Perkins was closing. The kids and I walked into the night, and as one does in such towns if you're a teenager, we sat on the curb. It's not that I'm like, ooh, yeah, war, said Theta. It's like we need a different system as soon as possible, because the planet is literally dying. I have a hot take on how it'll start, Paige said. She'd been sitting quietly, listening to her friends. Go, Paige, said Lily. I've been thinking, she said. It's unfortunate, but I feel the revolution won't start until something happens that affects white men. Like BLM, that came close. It was, they all agree, the summer of 2020, the murder of George Floyd, and the demonstrations that opened their eyes to the state of things. But it didn't take off because it's black people. This, the fall of Roe, probably isn't going to take off because it's women. But when something happens to a white man, they ban golf, said Carson. We all laughed. They ban golf, agreed Paige, and that's when the revolution starts. I told them about some of the other people with guns I'd been meeting, Rob Brum and his militia, the man who wanted to personally execute doctors. The kids said they weren't scared of them. Climate? That's scary. Trump is scary. The Supreme Court, they agreed, is very scary. They were afraid they wouldn't be allowed to love who they wanted, that contraception was next, that adult lives they'd barely or not yet begun were already being bound, taken, in ways neither they nor their parents had ever imagined. They were just kids. This was just talk on the curb outside a Perkins in Black River Falls. They were scared of so much, because they had to be. But they chose not to be frightened by all the little men with their big rifles. You know, said Theta, it's either we fight against them, we possibly get killed in a civil war, or we suffer like this, our rights stripped away from us by the minute. And I don't know if that's a life worth living. Mary and her husband are going ahead with trying to have a baby, because if not now, when? Because they know it's no longer impossible to imagine in vitro fertilization being criminalized. Because they're used to the kind of men who tell them what they can't do, and they're used to doing it anyway. Because they love each other, and they want to love and raise a child together, and they're willing to take a lot of chances. More now, medically, legally, knowing they won't have access to abortions should three eggs be fertilized. Might not even if Mary's life is at risk, to make that happen. I'm ready to be a mom, said Mary. I'm making that choice. They're going forward. It's Wisconsin's slogan, forward, coined for a state that was once the Union's most progressive. Because that's all there is, hoping for life, for freedoms lost, for freedoms yet to be found in this strange new land. Thank you. All About Eve. World-class equestrian, model, and daughter of the late Apple legend Eve Jobs is off to the races. By Britt Hinemuth, with photographs by Emma Summerton, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. Eve Jobs, photographed in Cold Spring, New York, in June, wearing various high-fashion looks. In his best-selling biography, Steve Jobs, Walter Isaacson writes that the visionary's youngest daughter, Eve, is the apple that fell closest to the tree, a strong-willed, funny firecracker who used to call her father's assistant to make sure she was on his calendar. "I have zero recollection of that," Jobs tells me over lunch. "I'm so sorry to let you down there. I have a recollection of going to work with him and drawing on this one whiteboard in his office that I believe stands there to this day, with all my little doodles on it. I would just subconsciously soak in all the beauty and gorgeous design around me. I note that there's an iPhone resting on the table between us and recording our interview. It's a beautiful reminder for me every day," she says, looking down at it fondly. "All day, every day, it really is. It makes me feel warm." Even if Jobs can't remember negotiating with her dad's assistant, I can attest that Isaacson got the strong-willed, funny firecracker part right. We'd first crossed paths at a cocktail party in Los Angeles' Academy Museum, during which she was quick-witted and wickedly observant and grilled our table mates with questions. "I'm a little weird," Jobs says now. "Some people get a little taken aback by me. I don't know where to place her, but humor makes you feel like you are living." I tell her it's clear that she doesn't suffer fools. "Sometimes one will slip through the cracks," she tells me, "but it's a rarity." The 24-year-old world-class equestrian and Stanford graduate traded Silicon Valley for New York City in the fall of 2021 after making her runway debut for Coperni in Paris. Jobs has since signed a deal to be a face of Louis Vuitton and will star in a digital campaign later this year. For our meeting, her agent has chosen a restaurant in Chelsea near the High Line. And Jobs arrives early in a crisp white smock and flowing trousers. The only sign that she's actually a 20-something are the Nike Jordan 1s on her feet. "I live in a very basketball-heavy household." Jobs is a self-proclaimed horse girl who used to bring carrots to her sister's barn and began taking proper pony lessons at the age of 6. Her parents encouraged her to prioritize school, but allowed her to travel for show jumping competitions during summers and spring breaks. "I wanted to see how far I could take this," Jobs says. "It's a hard sport to do, mostly because you only get 2 minutes in the ring, and you're working with something, an animal, that's inherently unreliable." She was in contention for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, but had to bow out after they were postponed a year because of COVID. "After graduating from Stanford," she says, "I was at this turning point. I had done everything I wanted to achieve in the sport, and I just felt at peace." Modeling, Jobs discovered quickly, is not entirely unlike show jumping. It's all about turning it on for 2 minutes at a time. "I was more grateful than nervous," she says. "I never foresaw modeling. And on a whim, I was like, why not? It drew upon things I knew, igniting the part of me that competing always did." Jobs is well aware how charmed her life has been, notwithstanding the untimely loss of her father to cancer when she was 13. She considers her mom, business executive and philanthropist Laureen Powell Jobs, a guiding light. "As my life unfolds a bit, I'm going to find my avenue to impact the most people in the best way possible," she says. "I want to take my time and get it right and find something I love, just as I see my mom finding ways in which to reach people." With Fashion Week nearly upon us again, Jobs hopes to be walking many major catwalks. At home, meanwhile, she keeps things casual. She has started a collection of vintage Apple T-shirts, one of which holds tremendous personal value, It appears to be a one-of-a-kind prototype from the Computer One era, likely made by her dad, when Apple was still based out of his garage. On the front, the T-shirt alludes to a certain biblical icon. Eve had the right idea, it reads. On the back, the text continues, she picked an apple. It means so much to me, Jobs says. I smile every time I wear it. the Magic Mountain, Herbalife founder Mark Hughes planned to build his dream mansion on a spectacular plot of L.A. real estate. But when he died of an overdose, it became ground zero in a legal war. Now his ex-wife is opening up about the battle over the billion-dollar property. By Jennifer Gould. Opening photo shows a panoramic shot of the spectacular property. High above the lights of Los Angeles stands the mountain, impervious to the Hollywood power players and business tycoons plotting and scheming below. Many have coveted its 157 acres, but the mountain has remained tantalizingly out of reach. Spanning a surface area bigger than 100 football fields, this grassy, lush mountaintop has been the prize. Once valued at $1 billion, of Middle Eastern royals, A-list stars, and mega moguls, Rihanna, Salma Hayek, James Cameron, Elon Musk, and others have made pilgrimages to the mountain for roving Oscar parties and charity balls. Yet the only creatures to make the mountain their home are the deer that frolic nearby. At other points, known as Tower Grove or the Vineyard, the Mountain of Beverly Hills is arguably the city's most spectacular undeveloped parcel of land. For the rare few who have owned it, the mountain has been both a blessing and a curse. The last Shah of Iran's sister once owned the mountain. She planned to build her brother a palace in exile until Molotov cocktail-hurling Iranian students changed her mind. Next came Merv Griffin, who set out to best Aaron Spelling by building the city's biggest mansion at its peak. Then he ran out of steam. In 1997, Griffin sold to Herbalife guru Mark Hughes for $8.5 million, setting a Southern California record at the time. Hughes planned to build his own dream house there, but his whole dream unraveled. 3 years after Hughes bought the plot, he was dead from an alcohol and antidepressant-fueled overdose. A reportedly $400 million estate, including the mountain, went to his only son, Alex, then 8 years old. And a brutal war ensued, pitting Alex and his mother, Susan Hughes, against the estate's three trustees, whose role was to protect the estate's assets until Alex turned 35. But as Susan levied in court, the trustees had plans of their own. Instead of acting like trustees, they wanted to be Mark Hughes and develop the mountain themselves, Susan told Vanity Fair. Launching numerous lawsuits, Susan alleged that the group made arbitrary and capricious decisions and were hostile to Alex. She also alleged that one of the trustees sexually harassed her, and she wanted them removed. The trustees denied her accusations, and Susan lost. She cast herself as a David against their Goliaths in a pre-hashtag MeToo world, one that negated her claims as a mother protecting her child, while the trustees retorted that she wanted to wrest control of the trust for her own benefit. The impression that everyone had on the trustee side was that Susan was litigating to take over the trust herself because she was the mother of the only child and heir, and therefore she should be the trustee, even though it was Mark's money and he was entitled to choose who he wanted to manage it for Alex's benefit, even if Mark did not have great insight into the people he was naming, and they ultimately abused the trust. An attorney who once worked for the trustees told Vanity Fair. Never did I have the impression that they were managing this estate because they cared about Alex. The trustees consulted a psychiatrist and a rabbi about the potentially harmful impact of wealth on a child. As the trustees' then lawyer, Edward A. Woods, said in a 2005 interview with the Los Angeles Times, does he need a chandelier, or would he be content with something from IKEA? Any kid would be fine with IKEA. But Alex had been raised in mansions with nary a budget fixture in sight. In court papers, Susan said Alex's lifestyle when his father was alive included vacationing with Mark at his lavish beach home, cruising on Mark's yacht, driving in Mark's fleet of luxury cars, and attending events of extraordinary prestige, lavishness, and extravagance. As Susan saw it, Mark had hired the trustees to maintain Alex's lifestyle, not downgrade it. These three guys are employees, sycophants and dictators, Susan said to a reporter in 2003. Susan wants Alex to have the life his father intended for him. Her lawyer, the late Hillel Chodos, said in a separate interview, "They loathe Susan. She has criticized them. They don't like to be criticized." As the court fights exploded, Alex was thrust into an unwanted spotlight, dubbed America's richest teenager. At the heart of the lawsuits was the mountain, which Mark had wanted preserved for his son. The property cost around $250,000 a year to maintain by 2020, but maintenance was never a question. The trustees saw its potential as a development site. In 2004, the trustees sold the mountain in a no-cash deal to Charles Chip Dickens, an Atlanta businessman, lending Dickens the money to buy the mountain, and the mountain was lost. When Alex turned 18 in December 2009, he hired his own lawyers and launched his own lawsuit to have the trustees removed. In 2013, he won, mainly because the trustees had botched the mountain sale so badly. Judge Mitchell Beckloff ultimately ruled the trustees showed a gross breach of trust that borders on recklessness and resulted in significant damage to the trust. The trustees had lent money to Dickens, a man with no experience and no money, then sat back and did nothing as his company continually defaulted, according to a court ruling. The trust is now run by institutional trustees at Fiduciary International Trust of California. While Alex, now 30, declined to be interviewed, sources say he agreed with the actions his mother took. "Their interests have always been aligned," a legal source said. "Alex has been through so much. He just wants to be out of the spotlight," a source close to him said. "He is just not ready to talk." Alex is an independent producer and founder of Spacemaker Productions, who recently co-produced Armageddon Time, starring Anne Hathaway, Jeremy Strong, and Anthony Hopkins, which received a standing ovation at Cannes in May. "My son's privacy is uber important," says Susan. "He didn't ask for any of this." Next photos, top of the world. The mountain's asking price tumbled from $1 billion before it sold in foreclosure auction for $100,000 plus debt 4 years later. Susan and Mark Hughes with their son Alex in 1997, 3 years before Mark's death. Golden hour bloomed as we reached the mountain's top. Ribbons of colored light and jet contrails laced the sky, and a family of deer romped in the distance. My guide exhaled. Less an aerobic heave, more a long sigh of relief. "Standing here makes it all worth it," said Susan Hughes. The mountain was Mark's dream, not hers, but she's ready to talk about her fight to keep it and her life with Hughes. "Did you see The Insider?" she asked, referring to the 1999 film starring Al Pacino about a tobacco industry whistleblower, and coincidentally based on a 1996 Vanity Fair article. "That's kind of how I felt for 13 years. Opening up today takes a lot out of me. It takes me back there." A drop of around 1,400 feet and out beyond L.A. lies the Pacific. On the 4th of July, Susan says, you can see the fireworks displays of five different enclaves, including Malibu, Marina Del Rey, and Encino. "I wanted to take Alex here after his father died to see the fireworks, but the trustees wouldn't give us the key. The key was in the hands of Conrad Klein, Mark's lawyer, and one of three literal gatekeepers who died in 2019. The other trustees were senior Herbalife International exec Christopher Pear, who became acting CEO after Mark's death, and John Jack Reynolds, Mark's biological dad, who died in June 2021. Pear stepped down as CEO in 2001 after investors complained that Pear, Klein, and Reynolds, all executives as well as trustees, had conflicts of interest. Pear did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Herbalife was sold in 2002. "The devil had nothing on Klein," says Susan. "He became the dictator of my life." During the first decade of the dispute, Alex's lawyers said the trustees spent $22.6 million of the trust money on litigation, plus around $10 million as payment to themselves, while denying Susan's request for the smallest of things, some of Mark's clothing, his surfboard, furniture that reminded Alex of his father, according to Susan and to court documents. Alex's lawyer, Eric Rowan, also declined to comment for this story. Susan had been the third of Mark's four wives and the mother of his only child. She was also his longest relationship. "When I met Mark, it was like this explosion," says Susan, who joined Herbalife in 1985, 5 years after Mark started it, and married him in 1987. "I had all these great ideas, and he had this marketing system, so it was like whoosh, it was perfect. We got it to $1 billion in 1997. And then I said, 'We did it.' And he said, 'Let's do another billion.' And I said, 'Not so much.'" In 1998, they divorced, and in 1999, Mark married Darcy Lapeer, a self-described actor, model, and rodeo barrel racer, whose past husbands included Hawaiian tropic mogul Ron Rice and actor Jean-Claude Van Damme. The next year, Mark was dead. Lapeer received around $34 million, according to reports, but Susan got to keep Mark himself. "The only thing the trustees granted without demanding the request come in writing," she says, and still keeps his ashes in an urn on a mantle in her Beverly Hills home, where years of framed Christmas photos of Mark, Susan, and Alex populate a wall. The couple first met at an L.A. restaurant. Mark had just flown in from New York. He was perfectly dressed, with his hair, and he looked so handsome. His friends asked if I knew who he was, and I said, "Yeah, the maitre d', and I'm the rocket scientist." "Everyone was laughing," Susan said. "We were having so much fun, like it was all in slow-mo. We were like Ken and Barbie." They were both into health and nutrition. Mark was a marketing genius, and Susan had ideas about skin, hair, and fitness. For a time, they lived large, then sold their home to fund their legal battles against Big Pharma, which tried to wipe them out, Susan said. For a while, they lived in a rental on Benedict Canyon. Their landlord, according to Susan, was Max Baer Jr., who played Jethro Bodine on the Beverly Hillbillies and was a son of the heavyweight boxing champion. They married in Maui in September 1987 and renewed their vows each year. In places like Cabo San Lucas, Tahiti, the French Riviera, and Hawaii, it was a little like a fairy tale at first. But Herbalife had its ups and downs, and so did the marriage. Mark, a high school dropout, launched the company out of the trunk of his car in 1980. He said he was inspired to help people lose weight following the death of his mother, who had been addicted to diet pills. Inspiration may have also come from a now-shuttered Sedu school, a controversial system of reform schools for troubled teens like Mark, whose education included fundraising from strangers. Other former attendants, including Paris Hilton, who attended a Sedu school, have alleged disturbing and abusive forms of group therapy. According to reports, Pear's relationship with Hughes dated back to his own connection to the school. By 1984, Herbalife was a $500 million a year business. The next year, however, the FDA, the California AG's office, and the State Department of Health cited labeling and sales practice issues. There were also complaints about health and safety, as well as allegations the company was a pyramid scheme. But Herbalife continued its radical rise, and Mark and Susan had Alex in 1991. The family bought Gray Hall, an historic mansion where Douglas Fairbanks once lived, traveling by secret tunnel to the home he shared with Mary Pickford next door. The mansion was also a setting for Kris Kristofferson's home in the 1976 version of A Star Is Born. Susan stopped accompanying Mark on travels, with Alex in school. When Mark would return from a trip, recalls Susan, he'd be dead tired from the long flight. I'd say, "What are you doing?" And he'd say, "I just like walking around the house to see what I worked so hard for. This is what you give up your life for." By 1997, Herbalife had topped $1 billion in sales. That's when Mark and Susan bought the mountain. And Susan filed for divorce. The mountain didn't cause their problems, but it was emblematic of them. Instead of enjoying Gray Hall, Mark wanted to build a 50,000-square-foot Mediterranean villa atop the mountain, with a wildlife refuge, million-gallon pond, and tennis pavilion. For Susan, it was too much. "I didn't want to build a giant house. It's a beautiful piece of property, and there is nothing like it on the planet. But I was happy with the house we had. You can have enough without having to go further and higher and bigger," she said. "You can be satisfied." Next photo, over the hill. A private cobblestone drive leads to a plot with 5,000 plants and more than 500 trees. The divorce was finalized in 6 months, with Mark keeping 98% of the marital assets. "He was a nice guy, and I didn't want to fight with him over money," Susan said, though outlets reported she hired Anthony Pelicano, who was later convicted on separate wiretapping charges, as an investigator. "I didn't need three houses, or a yacht, or things. We ended as friends." They even lived together during the divorce, as Susan renovated her own $4 million fixer-upper, a beautiful 11,000-square-foot mansion with a pool and tennis courts in Beverly Hills, a few blocks from Gray Hall. It was another smart real estate investment, worth around $20 million today. Susan leveraged the mortgage to pay for her mountain litigation, even if that meant she occasionally couldn't afford to repair things, like ceiling leaks. From the start, Susan believed the co-trustees did not have Alex's interest at heart. 10 days after Mark's death, according to Susan, Klein sent Susan a letter demanding she use the word please when asking for something sentimental from the trust on behalf of Alex. Susan felt that Klein viewed her in sexist terms as a dumb, greedy ex-beauty queen who was jealous of the fourth wife's inheritance. She also says Klein's behavior wouldn't fly today. But Miss Petite USA was also a certified court reporter. "I lost 80 hours a week of litigation to get Mark's golf clubs," she said, "pretty trivial stuff, while they were stealing a mountaintop or using Herbalife as their candy store." Even Lapeer, Hughes's fourth wife, says Alex and Susan were surrounded by sharks. Mark knew how to tame them. He said it was like going to nursery school, but when he passed, everything was off. The trustees, she says, turned their aggression onto little Alex and Susan, and notes she's thankful the mother and son have finally won it back. After Susan asked the trust for the Avuson pillows, the request made it into media reports. The trustees, she said, couldn't believe that a child asked for couch pillows, They blew it up to discredit me, Susan said. Susan, who had partly been raised in a Brooklyn orphanage and with foster parents, taken from her parents when she was 7 months old, says she felt very alone throughout the experience. No family, no friends. As they paraded around on stages around the world, Hotel du Cap Ignorac in Cannes, rented out by Herbalife, having Elton John play for them and the company, I was trying to get my son's Batman bedsheets from them. We asked for Mark's favorite T-shirt. They said, "Sue us," she said, adding that she had to file lawsuits to force the trust to pay the already agreed-upon $10,000 a month in child support. There's a lot of money. There's the company and the land. And all they have to do, Susan's voice dropped below a whisper, is just F over one little boy. It gets very tempting. Once, when Susan asked for $160,000 to pay for a 2-month summer rental in Malibu for herself and Alex, the trustees instead granted her $80,000 for 1 month. Not long after, Pear called to invite Susan and Alex, then 13, to a King Tut exhibit that night with his own son, who was 9. It was the first time Pear and Susan had spoken in 3 years. When Susan asked Pear why the trust wouldn't pay for the summer rental, Pear said they could if she would be nice to him. "You know, everyone always had a thing for you," she says Pear told her. "You are one of the most beautiful, unattainable women in the world. Here's my home telephone number, and call me when you're ready to give me what I want." Susan took Alex to the King Tut exhibit herself. Pear was there and approached her, according to Susan. Alex was just a few feet away, as she recalls, when Pear leaned in and allegedly said, "I'll get you on your knees eventually. I'm going to F you one way or the other." Susan says that happened in June 2005. By August, she filed a lawsuit alleging emotional distress and sexual harassment. While Pear did not respond to Vanity Fair at the time, he denied the allegations. "The suit is totally without merit, and I'm deeply offended and saddened she would resort to such tactics." Pear won dismissal of the suit. The courts concluded that the emotional distress Susan claimed to suffer wasn't severe enough, but they did acknowledge conduct attributed to Pear was grossly inappropriate. At the time, Klein's wife, Joan Dempsey Klein, was an esteemed and powerful justice on the California Appeals Court, the fifth-generation Californian who became the state's first female presiding justice. She retired at age 90 in 2014 and died 6 years later, in December 2020. And although Judge Klein had nothing to do with this case, from Susan's perspective, that gave him an advantage in court. Next photo is a picture of Susan in residence. She spent years embroiled in legal battles with her ex-husband's estate in an effort to protect their son's assets. The trustees had set up MH Holdings II H, LLC, MH2, in 2003, an entity that held the mountain, then known as Tower Grove, as an asset of the trust, managed by Klein. That year, after the court denied the trustees indemnification in a quest to develop the property themselves, MH2 leased Tower Grove to Chip Dickens for $0 and loaned him $1.5 million to complete a tract map with an option to buy the mountain. That was the trustees' first loan to Dickens. Though Dickens completed the tract map, he could not come up with the money to buy the mountain, so the trustees lent him another $23.75 million with no money down, even though another buyer had offered $25.75 million in cash for the mountain. That was the trustees' second loan to Dickens. In court papers, the trustees said that Susan signed off on the deal, receiving $250,000 herself. But Susan told Vanity Fair she never gave her approval and thought the $250,000 payment was for the tract map. In 2006, the trust loaned an entity operated by Dickens another $12 million for construction, the trust's third loan to Dickens, but stopped the disbursements at $10.6 million. As time went on, it seemed to Susan that Dickens was a proxy developer for Klein. In the ensuing years, Dickens defaulted on the loans and struggled to hang on to the mountain. His entity, Tower Park Properties, filed for bankruptcy in 2008. Dickens' company came out of bankruptcy in 2010, still owning the mountain. The trustees then loaned one of his entities another $7 million, a fourth loan. More than $5.5 million of that loan was disbursed. But by then, Alex had filed his own petition to remove the trustees. In court, Alex's lawyers asked Klein if he had done his due diligence and if he believed Dickens was good for the money. "Mr. Dickens? No. As far as I know, he's a poor man," Klein testified. Dickens himself testified that he had to make sure Klein was happy. "If I went against or disagreed with him, I was putting myself in jeopardy because my middle name is default, and at any time he could have pulled the plug." In 2010, as the trustees turned off the loan spigot, Dickens teamed up with Victorino Noval, a Cuban-born convicted felon turned Hollywood producer. Noval's biography sounds straight out of Hollywood, too. His father had driven a truck filled with weapons to help the CIA's failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, and then drove into the gates of the Uruguayan embassy in Cuba to seek asylum before fleeing with his family to the U.S. By the late 1990s, Noval, then known as Victor Jesus Noval, had defrauded the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development of at least $60 million and spent 3 years in jail on mail fraud and tax evasion charges and was ordered to pay $25 million in restitution. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.